Robert Bly, poet, translator, editor, critic, provocative character, won't let well enough alone. A magazine called the 50s, silence in the snowy fields, opening solitudinous spaces, New York City, Wisconsin farmland, map lines darting off the page, fellowship to Norway to meet my relatives, discovery of Trockel, Neruda, Rilke in Oslo Library, 3 exclamation points, deep image David challenges smug academic Goliath. Robert Bly, poet, won't let well enough alone. A mag called the 60s, teeth mother naked at last, organize read-ins against the war, light around the body, National Book Award, cash prize used to counsel resistance to draft, poem restored to public power, articulates national conscience, consciousness. Robert Bly, poet, won't let well enough alone. A mag called the 70s, dragon smoke trailing inward, untying Jungian knots, mammalian and reptilian brain mapping, leaping lizards, leaping poetry, great mother yawning. Robert Bly, won't let well enough alone. The 80s, work continues, poems of the twofold consciousness unfolding, integration of man and nature in face of ray gun. What next? Opening to us new voices, new modes and spaces of consciousness, stretching literary landscape, interior landscapes, making us feel, think, look, turn over, touch, explore, not allowing complacency in his own work or ours. Robert Bly, poet, won't let well enough alone. Gadfly, down from the sky not 4 hours ago in St. Louis. Mound Town, River Town, Bush Town, World Series Town, Depressed Town, Blues Town, Poets Town. Robert Bly, don't let well enough alone. Welcome.
I spent a little time in Russia this summer at a writers' conference, and I was touched at the way the Russians almost never begin a literary meeting without mentioning the writers that have died in the year or so before that. There's something about the Russians that are, they're open to feeling, especially in the area of grief. So I thought I would begin with a mention of Kenneth Rexroth, who died a few months ago. I thought he was a great poet. And he's really the father of Kenneth Rexroth, the father of Gary Snyder. He wrote those poems before Gary, and he's also the father of many of the poems in my first book called Silence in the Snowy Fields. I saw him several times in Santa Barbara just before he died. And I suppose a week before he died, I was in the hospital. And it was very strange. He was in the hospital with tubes and all of that. Strangest thing was that one felt there wasn't a single person in the hospital who knew who he was. And when he died, there was almost no mention, really. And that's a contrast to Russia, too. You know, on May Day, they line up for many blocks to put flowers on the graves of Pushkin and Pasternak and Akhmatova and all of those. Of course, all of us remember James Wright, who died 2 years ago. So I'll begin with a couple of poems of James's. I was with him when he wrote this particular poem. We were driving near Rochester and we saw a couple of horses in the field. And James said, let's go in and look at them. So it's a poem called The Blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, Twilight bound softly forth in the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They come forward to welcome my friend and me, who have stepped over the barbed wire where they have been grazing all day alone. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the dark. There is no loneliness like theirs. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild over her forehead. And the skin in her ear is as delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly, I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. That one was given a few years ago to about 5,000 high school students without a name, along with a number of other poems. And they like that one the best. It's a gorgeous poem. And it's an antidote to that horrible stuff we hear in church so often from St. Paul. St. Paul says, you get near your body, you'll die of disease. And Jim says, I'm not sure at all about that. Here, one more poem of his called Milkweed. All of you know what milkweed is? It's a weird thing in the Middle West. And then... when it gets dry, you open it up and these incredible things fly out. And they're each on their own little parachutes. And Jim used to love that. He'd come out to the farm and scatter thousands of milkweeds, which the farmers were not crazy about at all. But this is a wonderful poem in which he comes to a point that sometimes you come to in your life, sometimes not. It's a point in which you realize that the grief that you've suffered and complained about so often may be just what you needed. That there may have been no mistakes. And all that anger you felt in your 20s and 30s was misplaced. This poem called Milkweed. While I stood here in the open, lost in myself, I must have looked a long time down the corn rows, beyond grass, the small house, white walls, animals lumbering toward the barn. I look down now. It has all changed. Whatever it was I lost, whatever I wept for, was a wild, gentle thing. The small, dark eyes loving me in secret. At a touch of my hand, the air fills with delicate creatures from the other world. I'll do it once more. As Robert Frost would say, I'll read it again. Listen this time, will you? While I stood here in the open, lost in myself, I must have looked a long time down the corn rows, beyond grass, white walls, animals lumbering toward the barn. I look down now. It has all changed. Whatever it was I lost, whatever it was I wept for, was a wild, gentle thing. The small, dark eyes loving me in secret. At a touch of my hand, the air filled with delicate creatures from the other world. This is a bouzouki that I got in Greece a few months ago, and it's sort of the little orphan child of those. They use it in Greece in a rather extroverted way. You heard the Story of the Greek? That's the extroverted bouzouki. Mine is introverted. And as long as we're doing poets that are gone, I'll do a poem of Emily Dickinson. There's something wonderful, the more you think about it, in the 19th century, that we should have produced Whitman, which is one of our main maniacs. I'm getting sick of him, by the way. And at the same time, we produced the balance to that, which is Emily Dickinson, with her careful tact and her beautiful way of looking at the outer world without getting her eye in all the time. You know, Whitman loves the word eye. He's very fond of it. And she can write entire poems without using it. So I'll read you one of those poems. Her subject is, she's looking in the afternoon of winter, and afternoon light is coming in winter. Winter afternoon light. It's very different than summer afternoon light. So her job is to, what does that feel like in late afternoon in winter when it comes in just a few, half an hour before sunset? What is that like? That they saw so often in the old days, in which they laid people out in your rooms, in their rooms, she saw many dead faces. They didn't drag him off to the mortuary and shoot him full of stuff. They just let him lie there. And she noticed there's a curious distance on their faces. There's a certain slant of light. Winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tomb. Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can see no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. When it goes, still the sunlight now. When it goes, it's like the distance on the face of death. Well, I'm going to read a couple more poems of Charles Gunther lives here in town, and he's been a worker, as I am, in the poorly paid field of translation. And in fact, his work inspired me to do a lot of translation I might not have done otherwise. Is Charles here? He wrote me. Sent me the newspaper clipping, but then didn't come himself. How do you like that? So Well, anyway, I'll read a couple of poems. Antonio Machado. I think he's translated Machado, too. I'm just finally finishing a selected poems of Machado, which I've been working on 10, 15 years. He's a Spanish poet, born in 1875. In some ways, the greatest Spanish poet of the century. The Spaniards like him better than Lorca. Lorca is very flashy and wild. He's like fireworks on the 4th of July. But Machado is slow, calm. I'll give you two poems of Machado. How many of you know any poems of Machado? One, two, three. You got something to learn. You might read something. It's hard to find translated poets, but I believe it's very important to read poets from other countries, since we don't live anymore alone as a nation. Well, all right, here's a couple of poems of Machado. Antonio Machado made a living as a high school teacher of French in a small town in Spain. And of those of you who've taught high school know, it's hard work. After he'd been teaching 3 years, it occurred to him that his soul might be dead. And he wrote this poem, which I'll read to you. The wind one day called to my soul with an odor of jasmine. In return for the odor of the jasmine, I'd like all the odor of your roses. I said, there are no roses in my garden. All are dead. And then the wind said, well, then I'll take the water from the fountains, and I'll take the withered leaves and the dried up petals. And then the wind left. And I wept. And I said to my soul, what have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? And it's strange. I read that 15 years ago when I started to translate Machado, and I didn't even notice it. Because I was convinced that poems ought to be cheerful and fly off somewhere. I read the poem, didn't see it. Didn't fit my idea of poetry. I thought the poets were all supposed to prove that they are not only lively, they are high, wild, etc. But then, if this is so, what can teachers of high school read? And there's something marvelous in Machado, that he's willing to come down to those places when you say, no, I'm sorry, all the roses in my garden are dead. And he doesn't solve it at the end, do you notice? Rajneesh doesn't come in and save him or anything. A lot of guts in that kind of poetry. I'll give you one more of his. Is my soul asleep? Has the beehive of thoughts that work in the night stopped? And that water wheel, you know those wheels they have that carry up water? And that water wheel, is it just turning around now? The cup's empty, carrying nothing but shadows. No, my soul is not asleep. It neither sleeps nor dreams. It is awake, wide awake. And it sees with its eyes wide open far off things. And it listens at the shores of the great silence. Get a feeling of what he's like?
Yes or no?
Yes.
Thank you. I was in Seattle the other day, and I met a woman who does a lot of fairy tale work there, and she said that a Squamish Indian woman had come to town to tell stories. And she tells stories with her own people, and then whenever she pauses, they say, go on. And she pauses in the story, they say, go on. So she came to read to the whites, and she paused, nothing. So she paused again, nothing. People think it's a string quartet concert or something. And so finally she said to all the whites who were there, she said, either say go on or you'll turn hunchback. Thank you. That's right. Be careful. All right. So that's a few for other poets. And I'm going to read now a few poems of my own. And I'm going to do a little group connected with fathers. I think a man comes to his father later in life. You come to the mother first, and that's natural, because the feeling comes in through the mother. And in the United States, there's a great remoteness anyway with the father, as you know. And so it's very difficult. I didn't come near my father until the last 5 or 6 years. I just say the loneliest person in the American house is probably the male now, especially the older male. The women came through the 60s with a lot of energy because of the women's movement, which is still a good movement. But the males came out of the 60s more lonely than when they went in. I just came from Texas where there was a weekend on Vietnam. And several generals were there, and Walter Rostow, who was a real bastard. I could not believe he lied all through the Vietnam War, and he's still lying in exactly the same way. He hasn't learned a thing. McNamara has learned something. They say it's hard for him to sleep at night. His kids wouldn't talk to him for about 2 years. Anyway, a lot of Vietnam veterans were there, and I can't tell you what grief they feel. So there's this tremendous loneliness of the male who comes out of the 60s because when you came out of the 60s, what was an adult male? Walter Rostow? Is that an adult male? So there was a question as to what a male is. Do you understand that feeling? A lot of males came out of the 60s. What is a male? And then there's a great separation after the Industrial Revolution from your father anyway, because he works at some office and he can't be there to teach you, as always happened in ancient times. So it can also be said that often in the American house now, the father loses the son 5 minutes after birth. The only values in the American house now are women's values. And I like women's values, but I also like men's values. And in general, there are many houses now in which the men's values are not there. So I'm going to read you a poem called Finding the Father. My friend, this body offers to carry us for nothing. The ocean carries logs. So on some days, the body wails with its great energy. It smashes up the boulders, lifting small crabs that float around the sides. There's a knock at the door. We don't have time to dress. He wants us to go with him through the blowing and rainy streets to the dark house. We will go there, the body says, and there find the father whom we have never met, who wandered out in a snowstorm the night we were born, who then lost his memory and has lived since longing for his child, whom he saw only once. While he worked as a shoemaker, as a cattle herder in Australia, as a restaurant cook who painted at night. When you light the lamp, You will see him. He sits there behind the door, the eyebrows so heavy, the forehead so light, lonely in his whole body, waiting for you. Would you? Let me know if you want it again. Shall I leave it alone or give it again? I'll do it without the instrument this time. My friend, this body offers to carry us for nothing, as the ocean carries logs. So on some days, the body wails with its great energy. It smashes up the rocks, lifting small crabs that flow around the side. There's a knock at the door. We don't have time to dress. He wants us to come with him through the blowing and rainy streets to the dark house. We will go there, the body says. The body says. And there find the Father, whom we have never met, who wandered out in the snowstorm the night we were born and has lived since longing for his child, whom he saw only once. While he worked as a shoemaker, as a cattle herder in Australia, as a restaurant cook who painted at night. When you light the lamp, when you light the lamp, you will see him. He sits there behind the door, the eyebrow so heavy, the forehead so light. Lonely in his whole body, waiting for you. So I don't mean that only the males are lonely for their fathers. The daughters are lonely for their fathers. You feel it all over the country. Yes. Daughters want a more warm relationship than their father will give them. But if the father doesn't love his son, he can't love you either. And also, you know, people have been saying for years that males have no feeling. For 20 years that's been said in this country. And you have to realize that a lot of males believe that. Probably your father does. So if you want to make a connection with your father, you're going to have to do it yourself. Hear me what I'm saying? So, well, I'll do a couple more poems. I'll do one called The Prodigal Son. Passage at the end, which I mentioned how difficult it is to look into the faces of our parents as they grow old. I don't know why this is, but I noticed it with my father. My father's still alive, and he and my mother, in fact, just went to the old people's home last week. I called him up, and I asked him, how do you like it? He says, it's monotonous. I don't like it at all. So I wrote this a couple of years ago. The prodigal son is kneeling in the husks. He remembers the man about to die who cried, don't let me die, doctor. Here was a friend of mine. I'll start again. The prodigal son is kneeling in the husks. He remembers the man about to die who cried, don't let me die, doctor. The swine go on feeding in the sunlight. When he kneels, his knees on corn cobs, he sees the smoke of ships floating off the aisles of Tyre and Sidon, and father beyond father beyond father. This is a little Hasidic story. An old man once, being dragged across the floor by his shouting son, cried, don't drag me any farther than this crack on the floor. I only dragged my father that far. My father is 75 years old. How difficult it is bending the head, looking into the water. Under the water, there's a door that the pigs have gone through. I worked a long time in that last line, about 3 years, I think. In fact, I published it in the New Republic with a completely different line. But I realized that once you start looking in the water, I had to keep on it. I'll give you the last line again. My father is 75 years old. How difficult it is bending the head, looking into the water. Under the water, there's a door that the pigs have gone through. I'll give you, this is a poem in which my father comes in at the end. This is a poem I worked on about 4 years, I think, and I couldn't finish it. One night I had a dream, and I knew, even while I was still asleep, that it was the end of the poem. It's a poem about the way women have been pushed out of philosophy. You know, women were very powerful in Celtic philosophy. They were powerful in Greece up until the time of Socrates. What happens when you don't let women in one of the major things that one does? This is a poem about that. It began with a walk I took in the woods. The Chinese always recommend that you don't write your poems at your desk. You go out for a walk and wait to see what happens. Because what happens is smarter than you are. And in this case, I was walking in northern Minnesota, and I was walking in the woods, and suddenly I saw a deer coming towards me. Then the deer turned around and went back up the hill as soon as it saw me. So I began the poem there. And I'd written a lot of poems called Silence in the Snowy Fields and Eating Snow and Eating Leaves and stuff. So I was getting sick of those titles. So I called this poem Meditation on Philosophy. Why not? There's a restless gloom in my mind. I walk grieving. Leaves are down. I come at dusk where sheltered by poplars a low pond lies. The sun abandons the sky, speaking through cold leaves. A doe comes down the slope towards me, sees me, turns away, back up the hill into the lone trees. It is the feminine out in the cold and air alone, the woman turned away from the philosopher's house. Someone wanted that. After Heraclitus dies, the males sink down to apathy, to apathy, to not suffering. When you shout at them, they don't reply. They turn their face toward the crib wall and die. When you shout at them, they don't reply. They turn their face toward the crib wall and die. A Tang painter made the 6 philosophers. 5 philosophers are inside the open-walled house, exchanging thoughts and poems. Only one is outdoors, looking over the cliff, being approached from below by rolling mist. It must be that 5 of me are indoors. Yesterday, when I cleaned my study, I laid your papers, your watercolor papers, your sable brushes, and your watercolor paints, not on the bookcase where mine were, but on the floor. but there are thunderstorms longing to come into the world through the mind of women. One painting of yours came. It was a large, friendly bird with big feet. Stubby wings and arrows lightly stuck in the arms. Last night, I dreamt that my father was an enormous turtle with his eyes open, lying on the basement floor. The weight of his shell kept him from moving, and his jaw hung down. It was large and fleshly. Can you feel how it ends the poem? I don't know how. Somehow, when men evict women from philosophy, they get heavier and heavier. Finally, they can't move. Like Walt Rostow. Thank you. Ronald Reagan isn't too great in that either. Read you one more poem about my father. It's a poem called My Father's Wedding. And I'll just say one thing about the poem. There's a friend here from a little town in Minnesota where we were both brought up. Madison, Minnesota was the name of it. It's a wonderfully boring little town. And but thinking of it, thinking of my father and that whole generation of men, you know, there are some really disreputable types in those days. In our town, there was Ole Sand, for example. Now, Ole Sand made most of the sidewalks in town. Then he'd stagger drunk down them at night. And Ole Sand was famous for always sleeping with his clothes on. And when he blew his nose at the table, he did it this way. He was a scandal in town. Ole Sand, the byword for everything low. But those men are acting out something. Who's acting that out now? Since the Second World War, do you notice how all the men have become respectable? Universities have expanded to 45,000. We've got all these college-educated men. They wear beautiful vests, ties. So, I'll read you this poem. It's called My Father's Wedding, 1924. Today, lonely for my father, I saw a log or branch, long, bent, ragged, bark gone. I felt lonely for my father when I saw it. It was the log that lay near my uncle's old milk wagon. Some men have an invisible limp, stagger, or drag a leg. Their sons often are angry. Only recently I thought, doing what you want. Is that like limping? It leaves crooked tracks in the sand. Have you seen those giant bird men of Bhutan, men with bird masks and pig noses dancing on one bad leg with their dog's teeth? They do what they want. The dog's teeth say that. But I grew up without dog's teeth. I learned to show a whole body. I learned to walk swiftly, easily, no trace of a limp. I even leaped a little. Guess where my defect is. What then? If a man cautious hides his limp, somebody has to limp it. The surroundings do it. The car wall, the house walls get scars. The car breaks down. My car always broke down. Then what? If a man cautious hides his limp, somebody has to limp it. The surroundings do it. The house walls get scars. The car breaks down. Matter in drudgery takes it up. On my father's wedding day, no one was there to hold him. Noble loneliness held him. Because he never asked for pity, his friends thought he was whole. Walking alone, he could carry it. He came in limping. It was a simple wedding, two or three people. And the man in black lifting the book called for order. And the invisible bride stepped forward before his own bride. He married the invisible bride, not his own. In her left breast were the three drops that wound and kill. He already had his bark-like skin then, made rough, especially to repel the sympathy that he wanted, didn't need, and wouldn't accept. So, the words are read, and when the service is over, I hold him in my arms. For the first time and the last. After that, he was alone, and I was alone. He invited a few friends in. His two-story house he turned into a forest where both he and I are the hunter. I'm going to do the second half with the instrument. On my father's wedding day, no one was there to hold him. Noble loneliness held him. Because he never asked for pity, his friends thought he was whole. Walking alone, he could carry it. It was a simple wedding, three or four people. The man in black lifting the book called for order. And the invisible bride stepped forward before his own bride. He married the invisible bride, not his own. You know that feeling that some people have never been married? He already had his bark-like skin then, made rough, especially to repel the sympathy that he wanted, didn't need, and wouldn't accept. So, the words are read. When the service is over, I hold him in my arms. For the first time, and the last. After that,